is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming in from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. We need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for a time because we're going to have with us Professor James Fetzer, and we're going to be talking about the assassination of John Kennedy. Now, people say, well, that was a long, long time ago. Why are you worried about that? That was, what, almost 40 years ago, 1963, November of 1963. This is, so that'd make it 38 years ago. Why is anybody still worried? Well, the reason that we really should be still worried is because there's still a serious question as to what happened. And, of course, at the time, there were many, many theories that were put out. One of them was that the communists were behind this. They were the ones who killed John Kennedy. And then there was the idea that, of course, it was the Cubans. It was Fidel Castro, because, of course, our government had been plotting to kill Fidel Castro. And a short time before, our CIA or somebody within our establishment, intelligence establishments, had assassinated the rulers of Vietnam at that time, people we put in power, Mr. Diem and Nu. And, of course, Patrice Lumumba had been liquidated. He was the young idealistic Marxist leader in Nigeria, had been elected to power. And, of course, it was perhaps these had something to do with what had happened. And then, of course, there was a theory. It was rich oil men in Texas. There was the theory that this was been the mafia. The mafia did it because, of course, the Kennedy administration had really come to power because of the mafia. The mafia had rigged the election in Chicago and one other state, and that story was simply that old Joe Kennedy had gotten together with Frank Sinatra and said, look, you've got some connection with the mob. You tell them, we'd certainly appreciate if they'd help us with the election, and they rigged the election in Chicago. And back to probably one of the few things I have any respect for Richard Nixon for was that he didn't contest the election. It was obvious that the election had been stolen from him. And, of course, once the Kennedys were in, why, they dealt very badly with the mafia. I mean, maybe they dealt justly with the mafia, but they really went after them. Bobby Kennedy held J. Edgar Hoover's feet to the fire and forced him to really do everything he should have done to the mafia long before he had not. And there were a lot of people who thought the mafia were behind it. So that was the question. And then, of course, the whitewash that we got from the Warren Commission, the lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald, did it all by himself. And then, of course, Jack Ruby, the idealist, had gone in and killed Oswald because he didn't want Jackie to have to go through a trial, the pain of a trial. And, of course, nobody really believed that story because Jack Ruby was a lowlife, and yet he was associated with the mafia. But why would he have done something so foolish as to walk into a police station surrounded by police officers and kill Lee Harvey Oswald with the cameras rolling? Well, with us this evening is James Fetzer, and he, of course, has been analyzing this, I guess, about as long as I have. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Stan.
Well, why don't you sort of introduce yourself to our audience so they can know who you are, why you're interested in this occurrence of some 38 years ago.
Well, I'm a former commissioned officer in the Marine Corps, Stan, for openers. I was anchored out in Kaohsiung Harbor aboard the LPH Iwo Jima when I was awakened by the officer of the deck, who was my executive officer, about 3:30 in the morning to tell me that the president had been shot. And then about an hour later, he came by to tell me that they'd arrested someone, a communist had done it. I thought that was pretty fast work then. And, of course, it's quite obvious it was much too fast because the fellow they arrested, it's very clear from the research that I and those with whom I've been collaborating have done, that he was framed for this action. I am a professor of philosophy since I exited from the Marine Corps, and I have taught on many campuses at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, University of Virginia, Charlottesville, Virginia, and now on the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota. In 1992, Stan, I got serious about the study of the assassination when the Journal of the American Medical Association, in particular its editor-in-chief, began a propaganda operation using interviews that were being masqueraded as and presented as science with the autopsy physicians claiming that there had been only two shots from above and behind that had killed the president. I was very upset about this and, in fact, wound up writing letters to all the members of the Board of Trustees explaining how the evidence did not comport with what their editor-in-chief was doing. I contacted a member of our medical school in the Twin Cities campus who happened to be the secretary-treasurer for the Board of Trustees, and he arranged a phone conversation where this guy named George Lundberg called me as I was sitting down to dinner one evening, and I pointed out to him that you can't tell how many bullets were fired from the number that happened to hit a target. And he professed no interest whatsoever in how many bullets had been fired, only in the two he alleged had hit. Well, we knew or have discovered that Jack was hit four times alone. He was hit once in the throat from in front by a shot that actually went through the windshield limousine. He was hit in the back from behind, but it was a shot about 5 inches too far below the collar. So with no point of exit, it was a shallow shot, only went about as far as the second knuckle on your little finger. And then twice in the head, once from behind and once from in front, a shot that entered his right temple. It was a frangible or exploding bullet, stand that blew his brains out, the weakened cranium at the back of his head. Connolly, therefore, there was no bullet that transited the neck, which means the magic bullet theory is a complete hocus-pocus. In fact, Arlen Specter, who invented it, said at the time he didn't think anyone would believe it. And if you only know that the bullet that entered his back was 4 to 5 inches below the collar and that it only went in as far as the second knuckle at your little finger at a downward angle and had no point of exit, you know that the whole government position is completely unfounded and has no basis in fact. Connolly had to be hit by one, two, or three shots separately. Another shot hit a chrome strip over the limousine windshield. Another went into the dirt. Another missed and hit the curbing and injured a different bystander. So actually, the individuals with whom I have been doing research have discovered that 8, 9, or 10 shots were fired in Dealey Plaza that day, Stan, from what appear to be 6 different locations.
Well, I think that the thing that perhaps would be so applicable today is the fact that this is a great cover-up.
Yes.
And that through the years, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats in power, the cover-up has continued. And to this very day, much of the information is still classified. Now, why would they classify this information in the name of national security? We certainly aren't concealing the evidence from the Russians. After all, the Soviet Union, we're told, doesn't exist anymore. And we certainly wouldn't be concealing the evidence from the Chinese communist or from Osama bin Laden. So who are we concealing the evidence for? And I think that any intelligent person would say, if there is anything to do with national security, it has to be we have to conceal it from the American people, because if the American people really understood what had happened, why those people who run our nation wouldn't be so secure today.
Stan, you're putting your finger right on it, because look at it this way. If the official government position were true, if it were the case that a lone, demented gunman had assassinated President Kennedy by firing three shots from this obscure Mannlicher Carcano Italian carbine, wasn't even a rifle, it wasn't high velocity, and yet the death certificate, the Warren Commission report, the book Case Closed by Gerald Posner, who is an apologist for the government, were true, there is no national security aspect whatsoever to the assassination of Jack Kennedy. So if they have classified all the documents and records for 75 years by the Warren Commission, then 50 years by the House Select Committee when they reinvestigated in 77, 78, it has to be because their story is a charade, it's a hoax, it's phony, Stan. You're absolutely right.
In fact, even the House Committee, I mean, they came out and admitted that there were at least 4 shots that were fired, and then they immediately adjourned the House Select Committee. And you wonder why, after all that investigation and coming to the conclusion there was a conspiracy, why they would have adjourned the Congressional Committee, other than perhaps they were afraid for their lives or certainly for their professional careers.
Well, Stan, there's a very interesting aspect to that, because while they did adjourn, they conducted their inquiry in 77, 78, it would be another year before the report would be issued, and the report was overseen by Robert Blakey, who was the chief counsel, and it was Blakey who really ensured that the official report would cast the blame on the mafia. Now, as you were saying in your introductory remarks, the mafia had reason to be upset with Jack, especially if, as I suspect may have been the case, his father had reached some sort of agreement, say, with Sam Giancana or others to throw Chicago and therefore Illinois in Jack's direction if the election were close. And of course it was close, and Chicago did come in big time for Jack and help secure the election. I don't happen to believe that Bobby or Jack would have had been parties to any such agreement, but if Joe did, then of course the mob might very well have believed that they were being double-crossed, and in fact that's the name of the book that Sam Giancana's brother and nephew wrote about it based upon what he told them. The last two chapters are about how the mafia, together with the CIA, took out Jack.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, for our listeners out there, I just bought up half a case of those because I think it's such an important book. And if anybody wants, it's inexpensive. If anybody wants to know how to get it, why, they can always give our 800 number a call and they will explain it to you. But this is the most incredible book, but I don't want to get into that just yet, although I think that down the line, we'll want to talk about the book Double Cross, because it was written by Chuck Giancano, who is the brother of Sam Giancano, the godfather for many, many years of the entire mafia. And Sam Giancano, now was that Sam's son or was that Chuck's son?
It's nephew. It's Chucky's son.
It was Chuck's son. So,
but you know, Stan, it reminds me that for your listeners might also want to know that I have produced a video on the assassination and two books on the assassination I've edited, which are Assassination Science, published in 1998, which includes the most important scientific studies ever of the autopsy evidence that reveal that the autopsy x-rays of Jack Kennedy were fabricated in two different ways. In the first instance, to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head caused by that shot that entered the right temple, and second, to add a 6.5 millimeter metallic object to another x-ray to implicate that weapon, which, as I have mentioned, wasn't even a high-velocity weapon and could not have committed the crime. This was one of the fumbles that occur in framing Oswald because of a lack of familiarity with the weapon, but also that the diagrams and photographs in the National Archives of a brain, Jack's brain, as you well know, Stan, is mysteriously missing, though the explanation for that may be innocuous. It turns out that the conclusion of a world authority on the human brain is that the brain shown in the diagrams and photographs of the National Archives is not the brain of Jack Kennedy. Plus, more recently, I have edited a book, Murder in Dealey Plaza, the year 2000, which many regard as the best overview and the best contributions from nine different experts, Stan, in different areas. I had 11 in assassination science. So this is not just my opinion, but work of the best people that I've been able to bring together who've done research on this subject. Murder in Dealey Plaza has been wonderfully received. And by sheer coincidence, Stan, I just discovered tonight, before I came to get on the phone with you, that Amazon.com is running a special, a bargain package of Murder in Dealey Plaza together with Robert Grodin's classic photographic collection, The Killing of a President. So you can get the two of those combined for about a third off.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, you can't give the price on that because this is a non-commercial station. But
yeah.
All right, fine. That's Amazon.com, and there's a special on that. And
that's
so,
right.
Well, now, of course, I think, I mean, there's so many individual details. Have you ever run into Dr. Crenshaw?
Sure. Chuck's a contributor to Assassination Science.
Oh, well, fine.
Chuck Crenshaw, of course, was the physician who attended the dying president. In fact, Stan, you won't believe this, but when I was putting that book together and I spoke with Chuck, I asked him if he'd ever made drawings of the wounds as he had observed them in Dealey Plaza, in Parkland Hospital. And would you believe that 30 years later, no one had ever asked him to draw pictures of what those wounds look like? I mean, think of what a simple solution it is when you have a conflict over what the wounds look like between that's alleged to exist between the physicians at Parkland and the physicians at Bethesda. Just ask him to draw what they saw, and you can sort it out immediately. He drew them for me, and I published them as the first appendix in Assassination Science. Chuck's a terrific guy, and as you know, he also attended the mortally wounded accused assassin Lee Oswald when he was brought in 2 days, 3 days later on Sunday, actually.
Well, I think that the most significant thing I learned, that we put together a four-tape set on the assassination, and of course we were fortunate enough to get Dr. Crenshaw to spend an hour with us on the telephone, and you know, of course he was there when they brought in Governor Connally.
Yes.
And of course he saw them debriding the metal from the bullet fragments out of Governor Connally's wrist. and out of Governor Connally's left thigh, and yet the most miraculous thing happened. That bullet reconstituted itself, and suddenly it popped out. It was laying on the gurney next to Governor Connally when he was brought into the emergency room. And
well,
that's why
Dan, you're right on. You're right on. Robert Shaw, the physician who removed those metal fragments from his right wrist, said that it was most unlikely this bullet, when he was told about the alleged magic bullet supposed to have done all this damage, could possibly have caused the injury, since he had taken more metal out of Connally's right wrist than was missing from the bullet.
Sure. And then there were still fragments that were in the left thigh.
Right.
Was it right thigh or left thigh?
Left thigh.
Left thigh, okay. You said right.
Yeah, right wrist, left thigh.
Right. And for our listeners, you have to understand that here's Lee Harvey Oswald way up there in the Texas book dispensary. He's shooting downward at President Kennedy.
Through a tree stand, of course.
Right. And then, of course, the bullet goes through the back of Kennedy, supposedly.
Yeah.
Entering
through
5 inches.
Through his neck, allegedly.
5 inches below the collar line.
Well,
comes out through his throat. Now, that's very, very difficult from that angle to come out the front of the throat. Goes through Governor Connally's chest, goes into his right wrist, and then goes into his left thigh. And
now, then shatters a rib along the way.
And then it reconstitutes itself and has really hardly any metal gone from it at all. All you can see is the rifling on the bullet, which came from Lee Harvey Oswald's rifle. And then, of course, they sold that to the American people. And I'm sure you know who sold that to the American people.
Well, they had a little boost from a member of the commission who had the wound to the back, which, as you say, was about 5 inches below the collar, re-described in the official report as having entered at the base of the back of the neck. That person was the congressman from Michigan, Gerald Ford, who, of course, would later become Nixon's vice president and then the president of the United States, though unelected.
For very well paid for his services. And what about Arlen Specter? What part did he play in that?
The whole idea, the whole single bullet theory, the idea this bullet could have done all these fantastic deeds, was the product of the fertile imagination of Arlen Specter, who was then a junior counsel. Now, of course, he's the senior senator from Pennsylvania and a prominent member of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
I think that what is so incredible about this is that they were able to sell this to the American people. Maybe nobody ever explained it to them, but, you know, that's why they call it a magic bullet. It kept changing its direction and reconstituted itself. And yet nobody, I mean, just simply based upon that one fact,
yep.
There should be no question at all that Lee Harvey Oswald did not shoot the president on his own.
Yeah, many of your listeners may not realize how powerful is the evidence that this bullet actually entered 5 inches below the collar. We have the shirt and the jacket, which were not given to the pathologists at Bethesda, that show it 5 inches below the collar. We have a diagram written, constructed at the autopsy by J. Thornton Boswell, who was assisting Commander Humes, another naval officer, neither of whom had ever performed autopsies on gunshot victims before, showing it about 5 inches below the collar. We have another diagram by an FBI agent by the name of Siebert, who was there, showing it about 5 inches below the collar. In fact, Siebert even did a diagram from the side that showed that the wound to the throat was higher than the wound to the back. Plus, we have a death certificate executed by the president's personal physician, Admiral George Berkeley, that described it exactly in relation to the structure of the spine, saying it was located at the level of the third thoracic vertebrae, which puts it just to the right of the spinal column, which puts it at the same location as the shirt, the jacket, the two diagrams. Plus, we have reconstruction photographs, Stan. You're going to love this. Reconstruction photographs. If you go, for example, to the New York Times Bantam paperback edition of the Warren Report, you're going to find on the inside front cover a photograph from a reconstruction showing a big patch on the back of a jacket and the alleged trajectory of this bullet that's supposed to have hit Connally, and it's way below the neck. It's way below the neck. I mean, it's showing the bullet coming out in Jack's chest. And there are other photographs like that. My favorite is one that appeared in Newsweek that showed Arlen Specter with a pointer explaining the trajectory that the magic bullet had to take, and here they're showing individuals in a limousine, but the limousine, stunningly, is not even a Lincoln limousine that Jack was riding in, which LBJ had dismantled and reconstructed already by Monday after the weekend of the assassination, which, of course, completely dismantled all the evidence that it represented. This was a crime scene on wheels. You have Specter here with these individuals in the Secret Service Cadillac, referred to as the Queen Mary. And if you look below Specter's hand holding this pointer, you can see 4 or 5 inches below his hand this patch on the jacket where the bullet actually entered, so that this photograph that's supposed to illustrate the magic bullet theory actually refutes it.
Well, you know, of course, talking to Dr. Crenshaw, who was at that time, he was a resident at Parkland Hospital in Dallas. He mentioned, as far as he was concerned, that the body of the president that left Parkland Hospital was certainly not the one that was described, that arrived at Bethesda. Did you have that feeling?
Well, there are a lot of questions, Stan, that are being raised implicitly here about whether there was any alteration to the body between Parkland and Bethesda. I will tell you this, that the throat did not look at all the same at Bethesda as it looked at Parkland. Plus, there may have been something done to the skull. Now, David W. Mantic, who has both a Ph.D. in physics and an M.D. and is board certified in radiation oncology, which is the treatment of cancer using X-ray therapy, and who is an expert on the interpretation of X-rays, where he makes professional decisions that affect life and death virtually every day, is the person who has gone into the National Archives and who discovered the fabrication of the X-rays in this case, and has made the most important contributions in the entire history of the study of the assassination. Now, Mantic, in an essay that is just astounding for its breadth and depth and detail, a study of the medical evidence that is published in Murder in Dealey Plaza, has concluded that David Lifton, who pioneered the thesis that there might have been some alteration to the body between Parkland and Bethesda, in his classic book published in 1980, Best Evidence, Mantic concludes that there may well have been some alteration to the body. Another issue that Crenshaw is implicitly raising, too, however, is precisely how the body got to Bethesda, because it may have not been in the official casket, although all attention was focused on the casket, for example, when the plane landed at Andrews Air Force Base. I personally have spoken with Gerald Custer, who was the Navy technician radiologist who actually took the X-rays, and Custer told me how he was proceeding upstairs at Bethesda with X-rays that were exposed but not yet developed in order to develop them, when he saw the official entourage with Jackie Kennedy and Robert McNamara entering the building. And he thought it was very strange because the president was already in the morgue undergoing the autopsy, and indeed he had in his hands X-rays from that very procedure.
Now, what was the significance then of Jackie and McNamara?
Well, because they were accompanying the casket. They were accompanying the official envelope, official entourage with the official casket, which was an elaborate bronze casket that was out in this gray Navy ambulance. And yet the president had shown up at the morgue. If you listen to Custer and the others who actually took him out of the casket, including Paul O'Connor, for example, It was a pinkish gray metal type shipping casket, such as was used to send about 50,000 American soldiers, sailors, and Marines in Air Force from Vietnam. It was a cheap shipping casket that the body actually showed up in. He was in a body bag, whereas in fact in Parkland he'd been put into an elaborate, very expensive bronze casket that had been lined with plastic. This is a very peculiar thing, Stan. The guy, the funeral director who provided it, had the casket lined with plastic as though it were going to be reused. I mean, I find this one of the most odd features of the whole case. But Jack's body was wrapped in sheets and his head was wrapped in towels. And yet when he showed up at Bethesda, it was in a different casket, and the body was completely different in the way it had been wrapped.
No, there were just so many fascinating things that Dr. Crenshaw had to say. One of the things was he was told as a young resident, never talk about this. And, and the inference was your surgical career will be over if you ever discuss this. So he didn't talk about it for, I don't know, 20, 25 years, something like that.
Well, nearly 30 years, actually. Yeah.
Then he wrote a book, and, of course, he was immediately attacked and vilified by the Journal of the American Medical Association.
That's right.
And, of course, what was so interesting is he sued them for a libel.
Yes.
And they gave him $200,000 saying, well, it's not that we don't think you're a terrible person in the quack, but it would cost us just too much to defend our position.
Stan, you're right on top of it. Actually, it was $220,000 they settled out of court. But, you know, I was there when Robert D. Livingston, M.D., the world authority on the human brain, who had concluded that the brain shown in the diagrams and photographs in the National Archives is not the brain of Jack Kennedy. I was there when he gave his deposition for the lawsuit between, attorneys for the newspapers too, which were in parties to this lawsuit in Dallas. And a fascinating feature of it is that Crenshaw wrote a substantial piece for publication in the Journal of the AMA. They forced him to cut it down. They didn't actually adhere to the terms of their agreement. They forced him to cut it down to a little bitty piece, like a letter to the editor, which they then published in very small type under the heading in bold letters, obituary, so people would mistakenly suppose this was something of no interest at all. In fact, I published the piece that the Journal of the AMA defaulted on in Assassination Science, along with a piece by his quite brilliant attorney, Bradley Keziah, discussing the entire case. There's a book by Jim Crenshaw on the trail of the assassins, and Bradley adapted that title for his piece on the trail of the character assassins. They settled for $220,000 out of court, Stan. You're right on top of it.
Well, you know, I think what was really so interesting, of course, by the time I talked to him, you know, he was the chief of surgery, and I'd forgotten, you know, at a major hospital there in another city in Texas. And so, you know, at this point, why he was, you know, in the twilight of his career, and he was willing to take the chance and do what needed to be done.
That's right.
The other thing is, of course, most of the other people who were there just remained silent. That's a tragedy. So many people were threatened, and everything was done to keep them from getting the facts out, because there are all these little pieces to the puzzle.
Oh, yes.
But when you begin to put them together, you see an elaborate, and I would have to call it a conspiracy. Somebody was coordinating this because they did not want the American people to learn the truth. Now, if that was true then, has anything changed today? Are perhaps much of what we're hearing about what's going on in the world today simply being fabricated, and we're being manipulated by an unseen hand, by a propaganda machine that is so effective, it is effectively able to control what the majority of the American people think?
Well, let me add a couple of thoughts about that, Stan, because I think you're right on here. I mean, in the first place, there's been a long-standing disbelief by many Americans based on the sentiment that if there had been a large conspiracy, someone would have had to talk about it and the American people would know about it. Well, the fact is that in the case of JFK, there were individuals who talked about it. For example, the mafia leader, Sam Giancana, after the event, but Marcello in Trafficante were talking about it in advance. There was a right-winger down in Florida who was talking about it. But key thing and point I want to make here is, this attack on the World Trade Center was a large-scale conspiracy, and yet nobody knew about it. I mean, we're supposed to have a great intelligence apparatus, and I'd like to believe in this case that they are acting in the interest of the nation, and yet it seems to have slipped through. I don't know what those billions and billions of dollars we're spending, Stan, is going for, but this was a massive failure of American intelligence. So that's something the government isn't owning up to, a massive failure of American intelligence involving a large-scale conspiracy. So I hope no American ever again thinks that you can't have these large-scale conspiracies and they be kept somehow silent. But something that's also bothered me, Stan, tremendously, two other things, really. One is that the actual motivation for if these terrorists are who they appear to have been, if they were related to Osama bin Laden, for example, they're not attacking the United States because it represents freedom. They're not attacking the United States because we have civil rights. They're attacking the United States because of all the abuses the United States has exerted through the CIA, especially abroad. You talked about these assassinations. They have been going on through the entire history of the CIA. In fact, Harry Truman, who created the agency in 1947-48, said it was the biggest mistake of his life. And, of course, the biggest complaint they have is the way in which the United States has been so one-sided on behalf of Israel, a country that was created out of Palestinian land, a land that the Arabs felt that they had belonged to them historically and traditionally, and it was just carved out by the United Nations as a special protectorate and then a state for Israel. And the United States does not appear to have been even handed here. Now, they have legitimate reasons, or at least what they perceive to be legitimate reasons, for objecting to the United States and displaying hostility. And if our president can't even own up to the fact that these people are not just attacking us because we're free, I mean, can you imagine Osama bin Laden talking to his associates and say, hey, the United States, they got too much freedom, you know, they can practice any religion we want, we're going to go attack them for that? It's completely ludicrous. But here's one other point I'd make, Stan, and this bothers me tremendously. The day of the assault, the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, there was a story that came out of the White House. Apparently, it was initiated by Karl Rove, who was Bush's highest, his chief of staff, his highest advisor. and not as chief of staff, but as his most influential advisor, that the plane was targeted for the White House, Stan, or for Air Force One. But there's absolutely no reason to think that, and the story's now been widely discredited. My point is, if they're going to lie to us about little things, how can we trust them about the big ones?
Well, we're going to have to take a break here. We've got a three-minute time, and so you get a cup of coffee, a drink of water, and then we'll be back here in just a moment to develop some more of these ideas. This is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we want to point out that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And, of course, some of the things that we talk about are very disquieting. We'd like to believe everything is just exactly as we've been told, but I'm afraid sometimes it's not exactly as it's been told. And as George Santayana said, you know, those who do not remember history are condemned to repeat it. Those who do not remember history are condemned to repeat it. And we need, of course, to get people thinking and analyzing and knowing what's happened in the past, and perhaps then they can better understand what's going on today. So if you believe that, as I do, that we're really involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political battlefield, because nothing could be as complex as this without having at least some spiritual component, we hope that many of you out there would decide you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. It's as easy as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. And people who do join the Radio Liberty family ordinarily will either get the newsletter or they get the four best tapes in the month as well. And, of course, your contribution helps us to pay for radio time all across America and 5 hours every day. I sit behind this microphone, that's every weekday, and just talking to people, trying to get them thinking, asking them to call in so we can have a discourse, and hopefully we can begin to spread the truth. We can educate people and get them, when they sit down in front of a television screen, to say, not what am I watching, but what are they trying to convince me that isn't true? Because so much of what we see on television and read in our magazines and read in our newspapers just isn't true. Now, sometimes we do get true things, and there's all sorts of fascinating things out there, but then there'll be, if you get the truth, then there'll be all sorts of counter efforts to confuse you, and they'll print disclaimers or attacks, or they'll vilify that the article that did tell the truth. So our job is to try to steer you through the minefields, and hopefully you'll want to help us. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America, our future, our families, our freedom, I believe, are under attack today. And then please tell people about our website. It's www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And you can get about 60 hours of archive programs. You can get our newsletters up there. We encourage you to get them, to pull them down, to copy them. But, of course, we also hope that many of you will decide right now you want to become part of our team. And so give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we'd love to welcome you into the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Okay, Dr. Stan back here, and let's go to Steve calling from Santa Cruz. I think that if you just sort of just hold your calls for a while, we'll open it up for calls later, but we've got Steve on the line, so let's go ahead and see what Steve, if he has a question. Hi, Steve. Have a question or comment?
Didn't mean to interrupt, Stan.
No, that's okay.
I'm just trying to connect the dots. McNamara and Ford and LBJ have been kind of brought up in the mafia a little bit. Just want to know if your guest is familiar with Craig Roberts' book, The Kill Zone,
Yes. And
the ties to JFK trying to pull us out of Vietnam and maybe simultaneously trying to disband the Federal Reserve, which ties him to strong dislike to people much more powerful than the mafia, which would be McNamara and Ford and the Council on Foreign Relations and these really big organizations. And if you could kind of connect those dots, maybe what I don't understand is what was Kennedy's role in our history.
Well, you maybe why was he assassinated? Would that be a better question?
Well, no, maybe I mean why he was assassinated. There's a lot of reasons. But
all right. Well, let's get Jim's view on that. Okay.
Okay.
Well, I think your caller's raising very relevant questions, because not only had Jack and Bobby upset the mafia by an apparent double cross, the mafia also wanted to regain its control of its resorts and casinos in Havana, where it was running the biggest money laundering operation in the Western Hemisphere. The mob had been in collusion with the CIA in these attempts to take out Castro, and one of those who had overseen these efforts was an Air Force Lieutenant General by the name of Charles Cabell, who actually called Jack Kennedy about 4:30 in the morning of the abortive Bay of Pigs invasion, pleading him for with him for close air support that he believed the president had promised, but which he refused to provide. When Cabell was subsequently relieved of his position, just as Jack relieved Alan Dulles as director and Richard Bissell as his assistant, he returned to the Pentagon describing Jack Kennedy as a traitor. Now, it turns out that Charles Cabell was born in Dallas in 1903. His brother Earl was born near Dallas in 1906. And in 1992, Earl Cabell became the mayor of the city of Dallas, in which capacity not only oversaw parade routes and motorcades, but supervised the police department. And it appears there's no way in which that motorcade could have been changed to take the very awkward, peculiar route that it did, a change that occurred only a couple days before the actual event that brought the motorcade directly in front of the Book Depository building, so that if, you know, if you got your patsy in place, you bring the president to him, without having to take the patsy to the president, and that's what happened in this case. The remarks Stan has been making about this have been entirely appropriate. And I would also add that the Jack's intention to dismantle or change the Federal Reserve System was an extremely important move he was making that was bound to upset a lot of financiers and bankers in the country. In fact, he had already authorized the issuance of some $4 billion in United States notes that were backed by silver. They were backed by silver coinage. I remember when I was in the Marine Corps, I had one of these United States notes in my hand, and it had a red emblem for the currency instead of the traditional green emblem. And, of course, what it was doing was depriving this private consortium of bankers from the interest that they are being paid for printing currency for the United States government, so that we actually borrow the currency or buy it from them on loan, as it were, and we pay them the interest rate. So actually, Abraham Lincoln, it's fascinating, wanted to change this system to a system like this. And of course, he did not do terribly well in the scheme of things. But the point is, I think that the caller's right on in the sense that it was a very broad array of very powerful forces, including the Central Intelligence Agency. They pulled a bait and switch on Jack with regard to Cuba, telling him there'd be a popular uprising, that if it were unsuccessful, that they disappear into the mountains and conduct guerrilla warfare. They actually were landed in a swamp. They weren't trained for guerrilla warfare. Castro actually had advanced knowledge. Now, this is fascinating. It turns out that the CIA had learned at least a week before the invasion that the Soviets knew the date that the invasion was going to take place, and yet they did not advise the commander-in-chief that that was the case. So that here, if you ask me, if you want to talk about acts of treason, this was an act of treason by the CIA and not advising the President of the United States in advance that the Soviet Union already knew. And if, in fact, the government had any knowledge here of this terrorist attack, it's equally disturbing. For example, just tonight I printed off a story about Salman Rushdie, you know, that the author who had written this controversial work that allegedly offended Muslims, was given a ban that he wasn't supposed to travel on American Airlines for the whole week before the terrorist attack. Now, this is very, very disturbing, but it suggests the possibility that there may have been prior knowledge in this case as well. And if that turns out to be true, I would like to believe that some heads are going to roll. Certainly, it's an opportune time for the Bush administration for a catastrophe of this sort to take place.
I fear there are going to be a lot of people promoted, and I have no question. In fact, my latest newsletter deals with the fact that they had advanced knowledge. In fact, a wonderful story in the latest issue of Time magazine about this, this Arab, and he doesn't speak very good English, and he goes to a flight training school someplace, and he says he wants to get trained to fly 747s. And they say, well, now, what planes have you flown in the past? Well, he'd flown a little Cessna, and But he didn't want to learn how to take off or land. He just wanted to learn how to turn the plane in the flight simulator. So, you know, you don't have to be very smart to realize there's something wrong here. One of the flight inspectors called the federal government and said, look, I mean, this guy, he wants to learn just to turn the plane in the air. You know, he doesn't want to take off and land. Obviously, he's up to something. So they come and they arrest the guy. And they say, well, we'll put you in jail because your visa has expired. And that was about a month before the September 11th incident. Now, if the flight instructor was smart enough to realize something was coming down, why you would think the FBI was, and I believe that they knew exactly what was going to happen. Are you acquainted with Project Bojinka? This actually was when Yosef, Ramzi Yosef, was in the Philippines. And, of course, he had to get out of
his apartment. He was talking about using 6 or 8 airlines and blowing them up.
Oh, he was going to go after 12 of them, actually.
All right.
But, of course, I happen to think maybe it was an act of God. Whatever it was, he started a fire in the sink of his apartment, so they fled from there. And when the Philippine authorities came in, they found the bomb-making things. They also found a laptop computer, and on the hard drive was Project Bojinka that said, you know, we were going to hijack airplanes and we're going to crash them into buildings. So they knew that from 1995 on.
And yet, that was a real risk. You mentioned this article in Time, Stan. There's one in Newsweek that it bothers me tremendously. It's entitled "The Allies Who Made Us, Who Made Our Foes: How the Arab States We Call Our Friends Sow Seeds of Terror and What We Should Do About It." And it's actually, and it's written by a Middle Easterner, suggesting that actually it is that this money that's financing. You may notice how leading figures in the government have been saying all the money came from the same source. You're getting this from like Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell. I don't know if Dick Cheney has said this, possibly Condoleezza Rice, but they're not identifying the source. And according to this author, actually the source is Saudi Arabia. And it turns out that, according to his story, that not only is bin Laden, of course, a Saudi by birth, but that most of those who are supporting him in his immediate, guard are also Saudi Arabians, and that it is the Saudi Arabian government that may be financing terrorism by this guy, which, of course, if this is true, is absolutely shocking, because they were supposed to have been our great buddies. I mean, that was, it's close relations between Bush the First, during the Desert Storm, that was supposed to have been very important, and yet, of course, these guys have been refusing to let us use the command and control center that we built there during that time. And, of course, one of the reasons that bin Laden is supposed to be so upset with us is that Saudi Arabia is, of course, a holy territory, is the home of the cities of Mecca and Medina, and that American forces were ever in Saudi Arabia is to him a sacrilege, a violation of Islamic law as he understands it. So that one of the reasons he's upset with the United States is not just its support for Israel and the attacks that have taken place in the past on predominantly Muslim nations like Libya and Iraq, of course, but the very fact that American forces were stationed in Saudi Arabia, even though it was to protect Saudi Arabia itself.
Now, when was that article published? Was
this
that
week.
Newsweek? This week's Newsweek. Okay.
This week's Newsweek, yeah.
And what was the title, do you recall?
The title of it, The Allies Who Made Our Foes.
Allies Who Made Our Foes, okay.
Yeah.
Well, we could spend the full 2 hours talking about that, but we really want to get back to a couple of the other fascinating things, and I'm going to ask Mike, who's calling in, just to sort of hold his call, and we'll take some calls next hour. But right now, let's get back to Jack Ruby, because that, of course, that should have been a red flag for anybody.
Yeah.
Why would anybody, a low life like Jack Ruby, go into a police station when they're taking Lee Harvey Oswald, moving him from one place to another, walk up, pull out a gun and shoot him when he knows he's going to get caught? And that always puzzled me. I mean, that just didn't
make
sense.
Well, I just don't think he had any choice, Stan. Okay. I don't know if you remember this movie by Sergio Leone, who did all the spaghetti westerns with Clint Eastwood, A Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. He did a movie called Once Upon a Time in America about the mafia. And at the end of the film, a mafiosi played by James Woods is in a great dilemma, and he tries to get a friend that he has betrayed many times during his lifetime, played by Robert De Niro, to shoot him, because he would rather have De Niro shoot him. They're both toward the end of their life, but he'd rather have De Niro shoot him than have to confront the actual dilemma, the fate he endured when De Niro declined to shoot him, which was he had to walk out and climb into the back of a garbage truck and be ground up. Now, that's what actually happened. I think that Jack Ruby was in an analogous situation. He had a proposition he couldn't refuse. And in fact, you know, the fellow who shared a cell with Ruby said that when Ruby first came in that he was extremely nervous and agitated and smoking cigarettes, and it was only after he was told that Oswald was dead that he calmed down and seemed to act perfectly normally afterwards. Because typically with an accused, someone who shot somebody, they get more agitated after they learn that they may face the death penalty because the person they shot actually died, and that the emotional reaction would be just the opposite.
Well, I think maybe in just a few minutes we'll tell you what a Chuck Giancano, because this he got the story from his brother Sam Giancano, who was the godfather of the mafia. But there was
Stan, you're absolutely right. Of course, that when he was known as Jack Rubenstein out of Chicago, he worked for Giancana and was frequently described as Giancana's little pinky ring. You know, that in other words, the Giancana could instruct Ruby to do absolutely anything, and Ruby would be obligated to do it.
Now, of course, there are a couple of things. There is a film down at the museum there in Dallas where, of course, Jack Ruby comes out and he's saying, and I've forgotten who he's talking to, but he says, just get me out of Dallas.
Yes.
And I'll tell you what really happens.
He says that to Earl Warren, who actually came to Dallas and interviewed him there, but Warren, for reasons I cannot imagine, can't begin to fathom, refused to do it. Here, Ruby was saying he was going to tell him the whole story, only he wasn't safe doing it in Dallas.
And, of course, very shortly there, how long after that did he have that sudden death from cancer?
Well, it was kind of stretched out. I think it may have stretched over maybe as much as 2 years.
Was it 2 years
before he actually
that?
Died? Yeah, but it was on the verge of his getting a new trial. It took a while, you know, how American legal process takes so long and is so drawn out. It took him a good while to get the position where he was going to have a new trial, but that was the point at which he died. He believed, of course, he was being injected with cancer cells, and it may very well be true.
All right, fine. Well, in the book Double Cross, written by the brother of Sam Giancano, well, why don't you tell the audience what Chuck Giancano wrote in that book? Because I mean, this was the only logical explanation why a low life like Ruby, and I've talked to people who knew him, and you know, and at one time I read some things that were put out for the right wing conservatives that Jack Rubenstein was really a communist agent, and that's why he killed him, and there were even some things in the communist papers that led me to believe that. But then, of course, in those days, I was young and foolish, and you know. And then, as you begin to mature a little bit, you begin to understand that you get ideas funneled into your mind. They're planted information, newspaper articles, magazine articles, even congressional record reports that are put in there simply to mislead people away from the truth. So,
yes,
I think that the most
absolutely
logical explanation was exactly what Sam Giancano told his brother Chuck. And incidentally, it is in the book Double Cross. We just got a whole case of those because I wanted to get them before they suddenly went to the shredder. So go ahead.
I think that's a valuable service you're performing. Well, of course, Jack Ruby had been involved in gun running down to Cuba, and he had a very extensive history with the mob, and he was a much bigger player in Dallas than he's normally portrayed as being. Certainly the Warren Commission made no effort whatsoever to actually establish all of the credentials that Ruby had with the mob, and that the idea of his taking out Jack was a relatively straightforward extension of that involvement with the mob and collusion with the CIA.
Well, but I mean, why did he kill? I'm talking about why did he kill Oswald?
Yeah. Well, what was your interpretation?
Well, my interpretation was that they told him that they would torture him to death and torture his family to death if he didn't do it.
Well, it was analogous. You're saying the same sort of thing I was suggesting, you know, having to get into the back of the garbage truck, and be ground up. I mean, I didn't recall that precise part of the book where he was talking about torturing him, but that's pretty striking.
Right, and that's what the mafia does. That's when they give you an offer you can't refuse.
Yes.
You know, you don't have very much choice, and that is the only logical explanation why he would have done what he did. I mean, the explanations that were put out, he saw a sign, and it said, impeach Earl Warren. It was put up by the John Birch Society, and he got so mad he decided he'd kill Lee Harvey Oswald.
Well, the other phony story, of course, Stan, was that he wanted to save Jackie Kennedy the trip to come back and testify about the case, and that was just made up by his original attorney.
I mean, the thing is, all of this was so ridiculous, but there had to be a force and what are the forces? I mean, who could get somebody to do something as insane as what Jack Ruby did, unless, of course, they were part of the mafia? And we know that's exactly how they operate.
Of course, Ruby was the perfect guy to pull it off because he was in so tight with many of the police officers. I mean, he must have known over half of the force in Dallas. Many of them came to his carousel club. He'd offer them free drinks, and I don't know how well acquainted they became with the strippers and women who worked there, but I imagine it was pretty up close and personal.
Right. And I'll never forget when I was working in the emergency room in Santa Cruz where I live. It was sometime after the assassination, and a young couple came through, and forgotten what they were there for, but they were really sort of scared to death, and they told me that they were fleeing from the mafia down there. They'd worked for them. I guess the girl had been a call girl or something, and they decided to get away. And of course, they knew Jack Ruby, and I said, "Oh, I heard he was a communist. He's communist. That guy's, you know, a scumbag mafia, you know, and part of this whole thing. And if they ever catch me, they're going to kill me."
Sure.
And this is how that really works.
There are lots of indications too that Oswald and Ruby knew each other. There are numerous reports from the clubs of seeing them together. And I've spoken with Beverly Oliver, who knew women who had seen the two of them together. She may herself, because she frequently visited the club, though she didn't actually work there. She worked at a club adjacent to the Carousel Club.
I remember one of my doctor friends here in Santa Cruz said that they had the live pictures, right? On you could just see this live as it happened. And he said, there was one scene. Oswald comes out. He sees Ruby, and there's obviously a look of recognition in his face. And then he sees the gun, and he knows he's going to get shot. After that one, perhaps 10 seconds, with a look of recognition, it just disappears. It's never seen again.
Yes.
And of course, this is exactly what they do. And there's something that occasionally you'll get the truth. But then, of course, you look again, and then you begin to wonder if it was ever there. And I remember the doctor coming to me and telling me that story. His name was Gene Urich.
But, Stan, of course, the fact that we've discovered that the autopsy x-rays have been fabricated in these different ways, actually the autopsy report itself was rewritten after the original draft was completed under orders from a military superior. The fact that the brain shown in the diagrams and photographs isn't the brain of JFK. We've even discovered that the Zapruder film has been massively edited, for example, as the limousine turned the corner from Houston onto Elm, the driver, William Greer, swung out too widely, nearly hit a concrete abutment, and had to bring the limousine to a halt virtually right there. That's just below the sixth-floor window. It was only a shot of 60 feet vertically, 10 feet per floor, plus the extension out to the highway. It would have been the easiest possible shot. The idea that Oswald could have been located there and not taken his best shots, which occurred while the limousine was heading directly toward him, directly below him, where he had Jack's head, face, chest all exposed to him, is ludicrous, and shows that that there couldn't have been a lone assassin there who it was a matter of having all this triangulated fire and these very highly disciplined professional shooters waiting until the president got into a location where they could all take shots. But even then, it was so difficult to hit a moving target that the driver brought the limousine to a halt after bullets began to be fired, Stan. And from it appears from the eyewitness reports and so forth, and there are 59 or 60 witnesses who report the limousine slowing dramatically or coming to a halt, which of course supports the thesis that it slowed dramatically as it came to a halt. It appears that the halt lasted approximately as much as 2 seconds, and it was during that period of time that Jack was hit twice in the head, once the shot from behind that shattered and weakened his cranium, then the shot from the right front that entered his temple, an exploding bullet, the force of which, the shock, blew his brains out the back of his head with such force that the motorcycle patrolman to the left rear thought he'd been hit himself by a bullet when he was impacted with the blood and brains. And only then did Greer accelerate. Now, of course, this is such a damning evidence of complicity by the Secret Service, it had to be edited out. And this is one of the reasons why, if you watch that Zapruder film, you'll see it's one of the oddest pieces of film footage that anyone has ever observed, because it's so jerky. You can almost see the individual frames as they go along because they've taken so much out. We estimate that it may have been as much as 4 times as long in its original version as is present available to now, and we have, of course, 486 frames today.
Well, of course, there is one of the stories that circulates in the conservative circles, and I've always felt it was just part of the disinformation, and that is, if you look at the Zapruder film, you'll see the driver turn around, he has a pistol in his hand, and he shoots the president. I mean, have you ever heard that story?
Yes. It's known as the Cooper hypothesis.
Right.
For a fellow named William Cooper, who first advanced it using a rather grainy bootleg copy of the Zapruder film. Now, I grant you that this is an extremely contentious issue in the community. I can only say Greer clearly was involved in the assassination. He was the only one who could have saved the president once they entered the kill zone. And by the way, Craig Roberts' book is quite brilliant. And he's particularly good. He was a sniper in Vietnam, and he said the first time he looked out the window, he knew the government had been lying to us because he was a professional sniper, and he couldn't have made the shots that were attributed to Lee Oswald. When, as I was mentioning before, after the Greer continued to drive, and Oswald is alleged to have taken up his shots, then he had to fire through a tree. It's a completely ridiculous hypothesis and scenario. One point on which Roberts is particularly good, by the way, is discussing the profit motive of big corporations and business interests, including those attached to the Federal Reserve, as having had motives for wanting to take Jack out, but also the huge amount of money that was going to be made by the war in Vietnam, involving all the important elements of the military-industrial complex, a lot of which were based, home-based in Texas. But the fact is that Greer was complicit, and I think there's ample evidence for his complicity, whether or not he may have taken a shot. Now, I must tell you, Stan, surprisingly enough, I had a plane ride with Robert B. Livingston, the world authority on the human brain, who discovered that the diagrams and photographs in the National Archives are not a Jack's brain, down to Dallas after we had a national press conference where we presented all of this on the 18th of November, 1993. Now, you may be stunned that we had this national press conference because it didn't show up in any of the newspapers or television. We got two sentences on CNN the next morning, Stan, and that was it. The coverage was absolutely stifled, killed. There was apparently a big story at the national desk of the AP that was killed. It didn't get out. I mean, here we had absolutely sensational scientific findings about the autopsies having been fabricated and about the brain not being the brain of JFK, and yet it didn't even make it into the news, okay? And on the way down, Bob Livingston and I talked about an issue in Newsweek I had in hand that had a two-page photograph of frame 313. Now, this is a frame that's alleged to be immediately before the president is shot. And we were looking at the location of his body, and we were talking about it. I was explaining to him this hypothesis that Greer might have shot him. And Bob actually drew a diagram for me showing the variation within which the shot that killed Jack might have been fired. And actually, it was not incompatible. It didn't rule out the possibility that Greer might have fired the shot. Now, I don't happen to believe it's provable that he shot him, and I also don't think it's provable that he did not shoot him because so many frames have been removed. And they particularly involve Greer's motion. For example, very meticulous studies that were done by a fellow named Noel Twyman, who published a book, Bloody Treason. It's got 600, 700, 800 pages. It's a huge study of the individuals and groups who appear to have had a role in assassinating the president, Stan. It's a fantastic piece of work, Bloody Treason. He hired professional athletes, tennis players, to turn their head, to see if any of them could turn their head as fast as Greer had to have turned his head, if in fact the frames shown in the film are authentic and complete and haven't been edited out. And it turns out that Greer was turning his head from where he was looking straight at Jack Kennedy to looking full front forward in about half the time that it's humanly possible for these professional athletes to turn their head. Now, that might not sound like much, but that means like the guy who ran a 4-minute mile is now running a 2-minute mile when it's twice as fast. Indicating, of course, massive editing of the film. Another feature, for those of you out there in the audience who look at the Zapruder film, look how fast the Connollys move. In other words, detach yourself from the fixation almost all of us invariably have when we look at the film of Jack Kennedy since he's about to be hit, and watch the Connollys and where they move and how fast they move. I mean, this guy's supposed to have these 5 different wounds in his back, shattered a rib out his chest, in his right wrist, in his leg, and yet he and Nellie move so super fast, and where do they move down behind William Greer? They hide behind Greer. So it's very peculiar. Certainly the evidence indicates the films have been massively edited, that Greer was involved, but it's not provable, though I think it may be possible that Greer could have shot him. David Mantic, who's done the superb work on the wounds, believes that shot to the head actually was fired from the intersection of the Triple Underpass and the picket fence on the grassy knoll from a sewer, above ground sewer opening, Afghanistan that would have provided an ideal shooting location.
All right, we're going to have to take a break here, and I have to bid adieu. Goodbye to our listeners up in the state of Washington, and we have another hour to go. If you'd like to get the rest of the program, you can contact us, but pray for America and pray for revival. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.